Coming up on this week's book show, Rahm Emanuel is a former two-term mayor of Chicago and a White House chief of staff for President Barack Obama. In his new book, The Nation City, Why Mayors Are Now Running the World, he offers a firsthand account of how cities, rather than the federal government, stand at the center of innovation and effective governance. Rahm Emanuel on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Rahm Emanuel is a former two-term mayor of Chicago and White House chief of staff for President Barack Obama. In his new book, The Nation City, Why Mayors Are Now Running the World, he offers a firsthand account of how cities, rather than the federal government, stand at the center of innovation and effective governance. Emanuel argues that cities are the most ancient political institutions dating back thousands of years and have reemerged as the nation-states of our time. It makes clear how mayors are accountable to their voters to a greater degree than any other elected officials and illuminates how progressives and centrists alike can best accomplish their goals by focusing their energies on local politics. Again, the name of the new book is The Nation City, Why Mayors Are Now Running the World. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Rahm Emanuel to this week's book show. Mr. Mayor, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, and thanks for showing some interest in the topic.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and especially now. Just recently, we had three mayors in that race. Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, and Mike Bloomberg. One remains. Does that fact alone make your point that mayors are uniquely qualified to run things like the United States of America?
Yeah. Well, let me take one more step back and then come into it. One is, you have the former mayor of London, now the Prime Minister of Great Britain. And the basis of his running was on that. And what I found interesting as somewhat a student of politics, his first announcement was about building a train from London to the Midlands, kind of a very mayor-like announcement. Two, in the Democratic primary, you also had Cory Booker, a former mayor of Newark, and you also had Mayor Castro, who became Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. There were five candidates in the field that had a mayoral background. More mayors running for president this time than at any time in the both Democrat and Republican primaries combined over the last 100 years. So to me, that was a very telling sign. I do think, on a political level, when you think about the things that people want out of government, the confidence they have in local government versus national government, mayors are uniquely qualified in that office. And I'll give you one illustration, one anecdote at this point. Mayor Pete did not get the normal bounce out of Iowa because of the technical mess up. Two, his debate before New Hampshire was, you know, good, but not one of his best. Yet he almost takes Sanders in the New Hampshire primary. And the reason I attribute to that was when Biden attacked Mayor Pete, saying, you know, I dealt with health care, I dealt with Iran, and you dealt with cobblestones and streetlights. And the public in New Hampshire went, well, that sounds pretty good. I'll go for that. Mm. And remember, people's confidence in local government is at 75, 76%. People's confidence in the national government and being able to solve problems is in the 20s. You cannot have a progressive vision without an affirmation and support by the public for government being an affirmative force. Mayors dealing with income inequality, mayors dealing with public education, mayors are dealing with public transportation, mayors are dealing with climate change more effectively. So there's a host of issues that the country face where the national government's been lagging and this local government has been leading. So I do think they bring some skill set. Does it mean this is the window? I didn't really write it to say mayors are qualified to be president. I wrote it to say that cities and mayors are uniquely qualified to deal with implementing a progressive agenda. And if you wanted to, in these kind of dark times, so to say, you're looking in the wrong place for a birth of progressivism. It's happening at the local level. It's right in a theater near you. Cities are doing things today that they never used to do on income inequality, research centers, immigration, climate change, and they're still excelling at the things that you expect from them, schools, safety, libraries, parks, all the amenities of where you work, where you live, how you get from home to work, what schools your kids go to, what are your community neighborhood amenities like your parks and libraries. That's the real estate of local government. When you think back, which government affects my family's life? All the things that you would start to list on a piece of paper, all those services come from your local government. And then when you think about, okay, I want to promote something new, we're going to have a policy on, we're going to do things on climate change. You're going to be able to affect and implement local government policies on that a lot quicker than you are the national. Now, I want to be clear. I want a federal partner. You need a strong federal government, as we're seeing with this pandemic. But given that they have basically stood down or walked back from their responsibility, local government doesn't have the option to stand still. They have to do certain things. And I'll take the issue of income inequality. It's your local governments that are expanding educational opportunity at either the early childhood years or the post-high school years. It's your local government that's expanding the minimum wage. It's your local government that's dealing with paid leave, etc. So when you think about all those things, it's actually the local governments that are showing the initiative.
You say, rightfully so, of course, they're dealing with these issues. But back to two of the gentlemen that you mentioned, Pete Buttigieg and Mike Bloomberg, who most recently dropped out of the Democratic field. And I bring them up specifically because, A, you write about them in the book, and B, they were both, their last job was that of mayor. Both had issues dealing with minority communities, of bringing people from those communities out to vote and to attract them to their campaigns. These are charges, of course, that have been leveled against you as well. Is that part of the job? Do mayors get hit unfairly for that?
Well, yes and no. And what I would say to you is they're on the front lines of governing. A legislator, and I was a former legislator as a member of Congress for, I got elected to 4 terms, served 3 of them, and then became President Obama's chief of staff. They're on the front lines of dealing with a whole host of issues, and they did not attract, as you said, minority voters. They have strengths that they bring in building a sense of community, building a sense of belonging. I think if, you know, one of the things I worry about that in history, we're going to look at this period of time, and it's going to be known for its alienation. Mayors are uniquely qualified of weaving places of worship and places of faith, community groups, not-for-profits, and giving our citizens who feel alienated, not seen, not heard, not having a voice, a place of belonging and believing again, and most importantly, believing again in themselves. But they do have, you know, that's part of the job, is they have challenges where people in their own city feel locked out, blocked out, and how to create that sense of unity. Now, the truth is, legislators don't have that responsibility. They're, you know, I would say, as it relates to the minority community, specifically as you raise Mayor Bloomberg and Mayor Pete, that, you know, there are questions about Vice President Biden's voting record as it related to the minority community, and you saw how he did. There were questions related to Senator Klobuchar and her background as a prosecutor. I actually think it's a bigger issue about us reviewing the last 30, 40 years of the criminal justice system, and it's coming under an analysis appropriately that it may have tilted, not may have, it tilted way too far on what is called, quote-unquote, I'm using this as a thumbnail, tough on crime without a more balanced approach and more nuance to it that was required. And they got Mayor Bloomberg and Mayor Pete got caught with that, and not caught, but they had a record and they had to explain for it.
And how do you explain for it? I mean, obviously, Mayor Bloomberg, it was stop and frisk. For you, it would be the Laquan McDonald mm-hmm. case, a 17-year-old mm-hmm. African-American shot by a white police officer. How do you explain that? Even in this book, you talk about it, you don't really explain it.
Well, look, I mean, I think we dealt with it and in the situation. This is not the first time Chicago ever had to deal with a police reform. The big difference was this way we had to come, as I said in the book, face to face with it. We couldn't just do another report and put it on the shelf. And we're in the midst of now clearly implementing police reform and making real progress because we know it's in our self-interest in as it was in the past, but never really got addressed. And we have come to terms with this the problem between the lack of trust in the police department. And I did certain things prior to Laquan McDonald as the first and only city ever to create reparations for police brutality. It would happen prior to my tenure, but I thought that was part of building trust. We're the first city ever to deal and come voluntarily to agreement with the ACLU on looking at police actions in the community and where they were done equitably or not. I thought we had addressed it. But the truth of the matter is the level of distrust between community and police was far deeper than I fully appreciated, and I own it as the mayor. And therefore, as I did, never been done before, I went in front of the full city council, addressed issues that had never been talked about before, like the code of silence, and said, we have got to deal with this, and created our own task force before the federal government came in and started working on it. Did I solve it? No. Do I think we're on the road to reform with no U-turn? Yes.
When you talk about coming forward and talking about the issues, though, there's obviously trust is a huge issue. And it takes a lot for people, black, white, whatever, to trust their police, to trust their mayor, to trust their elected representatives, to trust their neighbors, right? So if there is a gouge in that trust, especially at that level, how do you turn it around?
Well, there's a couple things. One is, I think, and I write this in the book, there's a lot of cities all going through some form of change in their police. So let's deal with all the issues. Trust is a key component. I believe the right way is police reform with our police, not to our police. I happen to think the FOP is crazy. They're against any changes. That's not sustainable. But if you want the reforms to be sustained, long-lasting, not just principles and laws, but also to change the culture, you want police brought into it. So Superintendent Johnson and I did a series of what I would call focus groups with both residents and police together. We were in many, many, many church basements. I joked that I was in so many church basements, my rabbi was getting nervous. Okay? But that said, we then adopted as a mindset the idea of reform with our police, not to our police. And I think those changes on practices, training, technology paid dividends. We not only saw a 40% reduction over 3 years of violent crime, we also saw the policies implemented that brought a stronger level of effort to our police department and a better practice of what I call community policing. Now, you don't hit a perfect balance and say, there, we got trust. It's something you have to work on constantly, and you not only have to change the practices, the hardest part is also changing a culture, and that's going to take all of us, and it's not one thing you do. It's a series of things. Now, the other piece of this, which sometimes gets lost and left on the side of the discussion, it's not only the relationship between police and community, it's then investing in the community. Police can do a good job of helping you reduce crime. What you need to do is also use that window to then make investments that remove what I call despair, which is a petri dish for violence, mm-hmm. and replacing it with hope. And the difference in a child walking by on the way to school, a set of storefronts that are shuttered, closed, locked. They internalize that. They know what that means about them and where they live. On the other hand, they walk by a neighborhood with open coffee shops and open up to other types of retail with lights on, people working, people in a community. They also internalize that. And so police can be part of preventing, stopping crime. But if we want a long-lasting, it creates a window for long-lasting investments. And they talk about, as I said in there, three neighborhoods, Bronzeville, Washington Park, and Woodlawn, that a local government then has a flood of investments in schools, libraries, transportation, parks, that then create the kind of foundation for grocery stores and former food deserts, new coffee shops and restaurants, and what I would say is extended, emptiness of a retail economy, and the basis of what makes a neighborhood, one of the things that makes a neighborhood feel like a community. So you have to do all of those things, not one thing. The foundation is having, or a big piece of the foundation, not standalone, is a pillar between a continuity and connectivity between community and the police department. But it's not just on the police alone. All of us play a role.
Rahm Emanuel is the author of The Nation's City, Why Mayors Are Now Running the World. Let me ask a question that you talk about in the book, and certainly one that has dogged you for a long time, really, since you became mayor of Chicago, and that is, why would you give up being chief of staff to the president of the United States to be a mayor, especially to the mayor of Chicago? And I'm curious as to what it was about that position that was so alluring to you.
Well, one of the things I would say, there's a couple things. I mean, if you grow up in Chicago, you know, mayor's the big alpha dog, and I know I'm going to get in trouble having said it that way, but it's a big job. I know somebody I've offended now, but it's a big job. I grew up in my mother was what would be considered, independent politics in Chicago against Richard J. Daley. She ran CORE, Congress on Racial Equality, or was in the leadership of it here in Chicago, doing open housing, open beaches in the early 60s. But the mayor was a very strong position in that level. Second is my own understanding of politics, which was, the center of gravity was moving away from the federal government. I was honored to be President Obama's chief of staff and President Clinton's senior advisor in Congress, et cetera. And I looked at national government as the place. Now, part of that is in the Democratic DNA when you have John Kennedy, Franklin Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson as part of your icons, Lyndon Johnson. That's where you look. And I'm proud to have done all the things I did working for President Clinton and President Obama. But I then realized, when Mayor Daley, Richard J., M. Daley decided not to run, that the center of gravity and the innovation, the creativity, producing policies. I mean, one of the things I'm very proud about in the city of Chicago, we were the first city in the United States back in 2015 that said that if you got a B average in high school, we made community college free. Mm. We made all transportation, all tuition, and all books free. Dreamers could get it. First public scholarship a dreamer could get in America for education. I could still be, and I was talking about higher education access before when I was a congressman, when I was a chief of staff. I didn't talk about it. 8,000 kids now are graduates of the Chicago Star program. Another 1,500 are the Star Plus, which is that if you kept the B average in community college, University of Chicago, Northwestern, UIC, Loyola, DePaul, all had to give you somewhere between 20 to 50% off of tuition. We didn't talk about it. We did it. I remember when President Obama was talking about early childhood education. In Chicago, I created full-day kindergarten for every child, which had not existed, and full-day pre-K for every child that had not existed. It was not just talking, it was doing. And I think those are essential to dealing what I call with the diploma divide. I've always believed, as somebody that was once thinking about being an educator, kids start dropping out of college in fourth grade. They don't drop out in freshman year. And if you want them to succeed in fourth grade, which is precursor to college, you have to make sure they're getting an education when they're 4 years old, if not sooner. And so those are things that you could do. And the mayor of Chicago was part of not only the center of gravity moving, I was not one for talking alone, but doing. And I will also say, as I've said before, in my life, there's five great jobs in public life. The president of the United States of America, the governors of California and New York, and the mayors of New York and Chicago. And I've been able, fortunately, to do one and a half of them.
Why not run for a third term then?
Oh, have you ever tried to be chief of staff to President Obama in the first 2 years and then mayor of the city of Chicago? For look, here's the thing. I got elected to Congress in 02. Yep. 04, Nancy Pelosi tapped me to be chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee to take back the House, which we did. 06, I got tapped to stay on as head of the DCCC and caucus chair. 08, I became chief of staff to President Obama. In 2011, I became mayor. In a short window, I climbed 5 major Himalayan mountains. Both President Obama and Mayor of Chicago were 2 major turnarounds. And I had to be honest with myself. I was really tired and burnt. And I couldn't really do a full third term based on my energy level. While I love the job and I care about it, you know, Chicago, I'm not trying to insult any city. Chicago's not, you know, it's not Albuquerque, it's not Phoenix, it's Chicago. And you can't just do this for 1 year and then cruise for 3. And one of the things I'm proud of my career, you know, I start the book with talk about my grandfather's journey to America, et cetera. You know, I was in public life for 25 years. You know, it's the one thing I never did? I never hired a lawyer.
Mm.
And while I'm proud of everything I've done policy-wise, I'm also proud of the fact that I never got in any legal trouble.
And
so I didn't want to make a mistake in my third term, and I had to be honest about my energy level. And the person I had to be honest with is both the public and myself.
Do you think you could have won a third term? Because whenever, and I'm not saying about this to you, but in general, when somebody doesn't run for another term mm-hmm. that they're allowed to, they think, oh, well, they don't think they can win.
Yeah, I absolutely do believe it. And, you know, it's all hypothetical, but here's what we know. I ran 6 times, won 6 times. I was worked on President Clinton, President Obama's election. I was chair of the DCCC. I've not lost. Would it have been difficult? All elections are difficult. I've never had an easy one, but I would have won. But that's here nor there.
Which brings up another question of 4 mayors who are running cities across this mm-hmm. nation. Do you believe there should be term limits?
So let me be consistent with my policy. I've said this before. I don't think there should be arbitrary term limits. I've said it when I was in Congress. I said it when I was mayor. There isn't for mayor in Chicago. Elections are term limits, and the public must decide whether they want to keep somebody or not. That's what elections are about.
When it comes to the running of the city of Chicago, one of the things that I found fascinating in the book is you write quite a bit about how much you worked with other mayors.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a sense of how important that relationship is with other mayors and why that brotherhood, if you will, is so important.
Because, first of all, one of the things I mentioned is it's essential. So let's start with the headline. 2, ideas used to move vertically, meaning cities would do things, governors would do things, and then the national government would replicate. Today, ideas move horizontally from city to city, and we replicate and copy. I was the first mayor to go to a pre-K to college model. Greg Fisher from Louisville, very interested in it. He's now done what he calls cradle to career. Boston's copying it. Seattle's copying it. San Francisco's copying it. Oakland's copying it. Denver's copying it. We're all working off a sheet of music. Now we come up with our different variations of it, but we learn from each other. We find out what works in other cities. In Chicago, we're in the third of a 4-year revamping all our streetlights, one of the largest smart grid streetlight systems with LED lighting. The LED lights are produced by ex-offenders at a facility on the west side of Chicago. But the idea of the LED light smart poles came from Mayor Greger out of Vancouver. And so we copy from each other, learn from each other, seek each other's advice. Chicago is a laggard on certain things you and I talked about on public safety, etc. We adopted this predictive analytics in Chicago now. 15 other cities are trying to replicate what we've done on these strategic centers inside each of the districts of the 22 across the city of Chicago. So we lean on each other, as you called it, a brotherhood, but it's both a fraternity and a sorority. And we all replicate ideas, and no challenge a mayor faces, some other mayor hasn't been dealing with it. And that camaraderie and that kind of fraternity and sorority type system allows us to not A, make mistakes, or B, when we do learn from our mistakes, help other mayors avoid some of the kind of similar real estate or similar paths along the way.
You write toward the end of the book, the modern city under the modern mayor must become a place where people can live, work, and play. Finding the equilibrium among these three needs determines a city's viability today and into the future. But no city has yet found the perfect balance. And you write that after you talk about what a bad mayor is. But you can be a good mayor, you believe. You can be a good mayor who has really bad problems in a city.
Yes, absolutely. Every city has very difficult problems they're addressing. Then nobody hits a perfect pitch. So I don't mean to do this, but since you asked.
Yes.
I mean, look, I took the train to work. Still do. I did it 2 to 3 times a week. We've made a major investment in our mass transit system. Our on-time arrival is 95%. New York City's 54%.
Right.
Not that I'm competitive, but I thought you should know that. Okay? Now, New York has actually come and said, okay, what has Chicago done? I met with the governor and the mayor of the governor of Massachusetts, the mayor of Boston, because they asked me to come in and talk about our mass transit. They're doing certain things economically that were unbelievable. One of the things we've done well is our mass transit. A lot of other cities replicated our community college. Think about this. Mayor Bloomberg convinced Cornell and the Technion to come and do a research center at Roosevelt Island. 10 years hence, some people are now talking about New York City rivaling the Valley. Now, New York City has a transportation problem. They have an airport problem, transportation, both public and airport, et cetera. I think Chicago's unbelievably ahead of them on certain other things. We have other issues on our pensions, our safety. So no city has it perfect. Some of them have real strengths and assets. Some of them have weaknesses or liabilities. When I became into office, the federal government had oversight into our public housing. I got us from underneath that, and the judge said we had met all the goals when it came to meeting that on public housing. New York City is going into some federal oversight of their public housing. Now, there's certain strengths to New York City. There's certain weaknesses. There's certain strengths to Chicago. The question is, are you facing the future, and are you willing to meet the challenges head on, not kick them down the road, and address those challenges? It doesn't mean you solve the problems. Are you making progress on them? You know, two things. One, the decisions we make over the 2 to next 3 years will determine what the city will look like in 20 to 30 years. Do you run away from your challenges, hope, and ignore them, hoping they go away? My view is they only become bigger problems. Or two, do you adopt a philosophy of knowing what your strengths are, doubling down on those strengths so you have the resources to begin to deal with what I would call your weaknesses and liability? You don't get everything 100%, but you can be a good mayor and have real challenges. There's no city today, whatever you tell me about their strengths, that doesn't have challenges and problems. And the question is, do you have a leader who's willing to face them?
Rahm Emanuel's new book is The Nation's City, Why Mayors Are Now Running the World. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.